Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill. Today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we are honored to have Dr. Faith Mitchell to talk about her book, Hoodoo Medicine, which is a classic when it comes to African-American herbalism. The book is especially wonderful because she was speaking with actual Gullah Geechee elders in that community, and so got firsthand accounts, but also has a lot of scholarly references in it. And a lot of times in books these days, you're not going to find the actual references, which I think are very important. So it's a really wonderful book, and we're really excited to talk with Faith. Just a couple of announcements. We are planning the second annual Plant Cunning Conference at our small farm in central New York for the weekend of July 26th, 27th, 28th. And tickets are not available yet, but it's going to be a fantastic time. We have Pam Montgomery, Becky Beyer, Seven Song, and a lot of other wonderful speakers and musicians coming. Also, I am still available for Vedic astrology readings. If that's something you're interested in, hit me up at info@plantcunning.com. Okay, I hope you enjoy the episode. Oh, and please like, subscribe, share, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, all those places. Thank you. So today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we are very grateful to have Dr. Faith Mitchell. And Faith has written a wonderful book, which has now become a classic, called Hoodoo Medicine. And that comes from previously engaging in the Gullah Geechee community in the Sea Islands even earlier in the 70s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really fantastic resource, but there's so many other things that you're involved in too, Faith. So first, how are you today?
I'm fine, and I'm so pleased to be talking to you.
Likewise. Yeah, it's really an honor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So usually we start off the show by asking, what brought you to the plant path? What got you interested in the history of herbalism and herbal magic and hoodoo and conjure and root work and all these things?
I actually got started on that path when I was a child. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Michigan in a rural community. How we ended up in the rural community is kind of a little snippet of Black history in a sense, mm-hmm. because my parents wanted to move to Ann Arbor, Michigan, you know, where the university is. Mm-hmm. And I can remember I was about 6 years old. They were showing us houses, but they only wanted to show us houses in the little two-block Black community within Ann Arbor. And my parents didn't want to be kind of confined in that way. Right. So they ended up moving into this rural area that at the time was, I don't know, maybe 25 minutes out of town. Now it's much closer. But we were surrounded by woods. And it was a blessing. I mean, I think from the time I was a very small child, I just resonated with that setting. And very soon started, you know, walking through the woods. I felt completely safe walking through the woods with my dog and taking walks with my parents. And then, you know, at some point you're looking at the plants and you're wondering, what's the name of this plant? And you know, I don't know when I first learned that people used plants for medicine, but then I just remember, even as a kid, with the resources that were available then, that was quite a while ago. So you didn't have the kind of information you have now, and of course, no internet, but trying to learn how American Indians had used these different plants and brewing up teas and then drinking them, and they tasted terrible, but you know, I knew that they were said to have different powers and things like that. So it just kind of started like that. And I can remember by the time I left Michigan to go to California to go to graduate school, I felt like I knew the names of almost every native plant. Now, I could have been fooling myself, but I felt like I knew the names and something about all of the plants. So I've always like resonated with plants.
Yeah.
And then the path that took me to hoodoo medicine started in the early 70s. Actually, I was still in Michigan. I was an undergraduate student in anthropology, and a friend had been doing research on the Gullah Geechee people in South Carolina. I had never heard of them, but he wanted to organize like a little research trip. And he got some funds from the anthropology department. And the professor who helped him kind of get the money said, I want you to take a girl or woman with you. So he asked me, do you want to go to South Carolina? And I said, of course. I knew nothing about it. I had never been in the South growing up in Michigan. But something in me just said, yes, I want this experience. So we went to the Sea Islands, and that was the first of three research trips that I took there. And it was just completely life-changing because, first of all, if you've been there, it's just so beautiful. Oh my God. With the salt creeks and the grasses and the palm trees and, the oysters and the shrimp and the fish, it's just full of life. And if you like heat, like I do, wonderfully hot, almost tropical. And then the people who live there on the island that we spent time on, it was still predominantly Black, predominantly Gullah Geechee, and just beginning the transition that we might want to talk about, which has affected a lot of the islands with gentrification. So now they're like resort destinations, and it's really painful to me to go down there because, when I was going, they were just little local communities, kind of traditional communities, very different from what you see, like if you go to Hilton Head or Kiowa Island or some of the other islands. But the reason I was saying it was transforming because there's this, a very long history in those islands. They were always predominantly African American. And there's evidence that even when the slave trade was abolished in 1808, that there was still like an underground sort of slave trade that continued there. So the upshot was that there's a very strong African tradition there that's stronger than in a lot of other parts of the country. And it's reflected in the food and the music and the religious practices and the language and the folk stories and in the folk medicine, as I was to learn when I started asking people about what do you do when you get sick. But when I first got there, I was just feeling like, oh, I'm just kind of immersed in this culturally rich community that's so different from where I grew up. And it wasn't until the third trip that I took there that I thought, let me ask people, what do you do when you get sick? Because by that time, it was clear there were no doctors on the island. So on the one hand, you have this kind of cultural richness. It was very agricultural community. It was a neglected part of Charleston County. So they had no public transportation. A lot of people didn't have running water. There was no clinic or anything like that. And so you realize, well, wow, when people are getting sick, they are really on their own. And that's where I started by just asking people, and they knew me by that time because it was the third visit. Like, what do you do? What do you do if you have a cold, or what do you do if the, so you just start with a simple question like that. And it's from that the book Hoodoo Medicine was born. So actually, you mentioned it being published in 98. It's actually older than that. It is coming up on its 50th anniversary
Oh,
almost. I
wow.
first published it, I know, I was a kid. I first published it in 1978. And Ishmael Reed, I don't know if you're familiar with his name, but he's a famous novelist, had his own publishing company, Reed Cannon Johnson. And he published it, and he's the one who gave it the title Hoodoo Medicine. And at the time I told him, well, hoodoo is actually a little bit different from what I'm talking about in my book. And he was like, yeah, but hoodoo will get people's attention. We're going to call it Hoodoo Medicine. And so there it was. And then 20 years later or so, I republished it. I contacted a small publisher who republished it. She went out of business, and it lives on Amazon. But the interesting thing is that the interest in it has just grown and grown and grown, and I feel so fortunate to have to be alive, 50 years after, it first came out, almost 50 years, and to see the reception and the interest in it. And there's a whole kind of renaissance in South Carolina, of Gullah Geechee people in terms of interest in their traditions, and they have festivals now, and just this whole kind of up, and what you would call it, just surge upward activity. And you see it on social media, and you see it in terms of, when you go down to Charleston, you can take historical tours and stuff. And people have really tapped into the book, which is wonderful. I'm really happy that it was a way to preserve that culture.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there it seems like at the time that you were writing it, it was starting to go out of the cultural consciousness. And because it was like it was old fashioned and not cool anymore, the young people were wanted to do new things. And I see that happening in a lot of like nowadays in the 2020s, 2010s even, people are starting to get more interested in their traditional cultural lineages and what made like in Appalachia. You know, Italian American folk magic and medicine and all these heritages, you know. It's
That's so
definitely up
true.
on.
Because especially when I was in like Wadmalaw Island, which is where I did the research, there were very few jobs. I mean, it was agricultural, as I was mentioning, and then they also had like fishing. So there were some men who worked on the fishing boats. Lots of people worked like picking tomatoes and things like that. And those were the older people. But the younger people, people by younger, in their 20s, 30s, 40s had left for the most part because there wasn't any real work to do. And so they were in DC or New York or in Charleston itself. And to your point, they were leaving that kind of very rural life behind. They were going into the military, and traveling the world and so forth. So when the book first came out, yeah, it was, I think the audience for it was much smaller. People were not kind of tapping into those traditions. But I'm so happy I recorded the information when I did because it serves like a generational bridge. Because like when I would go there in the summer, it would be older people, the elders, and the grandkids. But the people that elders would normally transmit knowledge to weren't even there. But now they have the book as a reference, which really helps a lot.
How cool it is that you got to fill that function, you know? That's
I'm grateful. I'm just grateful. And I'm grateful to the younger, people, like I said, who are part of this kind of Gullah Geechee revival. I'm so grateful to them for rediscovering the book and elevating it.
Yeah, and what you talked about at the beginning, being out in the woods all the time as a kid, like that's my experience too. When I was a kid, I was out in the woods all the time, and a lot of the people we talk to have a similar experience. And I think that builds that biophilia, you know, the love of natural world and love of the plants, and the ecosystem, the land down there in the Sea Islands is it's a very unique bioregion. Can you tell us a little bit about the Sea Islands and the land there?
Well, it's interesting when you said that, it just made me think of it's like one of those settings where the land has so much power. First of all, it's rural, so there's more land and more foliage and everything than there are people. You're outnumbered, so to speak. And the land is, it has such personality. As I was saying, you've got the salt creeks and they smell like salt. So that's like one of the first things when you go down there. There's this odor that hits you. There's a technical name for it, but I don't remember what it is. But there's this salty, kind of muddy smell that you get. And then you have the pine trees, with the kind of sound that they make when the wind is going through them, and the palmettos and egrets and herons and other birds, and as I mentioned, like oysters and shrimp and fish. So it's just like this incredible abundant environment, and that was one of the things that I came to love and understand about the Sea Islands, is that at the time that I was there, it was materially poor. I mean, in the sense that some people had wood stoves, as I said, people had outhouses. Lots of people didn't have running water. They might not have cars. So by one metric, they were poor. But by the metric of kind of culture, they were so rich. And they shared that richness with me and people that, because each time I went down, I was with somebody. Like the first time we were just kind of visiting the community and going to church and coming to understand it. Then I went back a couple times with a woman who was studying the language in particular, and she wrote one of the first books connecting Gullah English with English that's spoken in Sierra Leone. You know, there are actually some parallels because they're like African influenced English. So anyway, it was always with somebody, but wait, I've lost my train of thought. Uh-oh,
Well, we were just asking about the land itself, but I'm also curious if you wanted to tell us more about the Gullah Geechee people themselves and
So the Gullah Geechee people themselves are, as I mentioned, they have this strong African heritage that is reflected in this cultural richness that I'm describing that comes out in the stories and the English that they speak and foods that they cook. It's almost like New Orleans, where you have like these very strong cultural traditions that you can't escape when you go there. And the black people always outnumbered whites in that environment because for a couple of reasons at least. One thing is they had these huge plantations, so you know, with lots of enslaved people. So, you know, because of the size of the plantations, you had the kind of the whites were outnumbered, but also because it is this kind of tropical environment with lots of mosquitoes and ants, biting ants and mosquitoes and poisonous snakes and all, it was believed to be an unhealthy environment for whites. And you know, they had malaria and you know, they had other diseases. And so you had these, imagine these big plantations dominated by people maybe born in Africa, or as I said, illegally, you know, shipped from Africa and their descendants. So it was this kind of cultural concentration that was unusual in the United States. It's more like what you find in the Caribbean, because I also did research in Jamaica and you know, saw a lot of parallels between Jamaica and the Sea Islands. And when I was there in the early 70s, you still had people who spoke almost, you would say, like a very pure kind of Gullah English, very hard for us to understand. Again, after I went to Jamaica and you know spent a year listening to Jamaican patois, then I thought, well, if I went back to the Sea Islands, I'd probably be able to understand some of these folks more. But so you had this, you really had a sense of the cultural roots when I was there. And I will just say, and this affects the medicine too. When I talk about the folk stories, there's a real strong belief in ghosts. And when you're in an environment, you mentioned your research in Appalachia. You know, when you're in an environment where people believe in ghosts, it's scary because
And
you're
they
like,
show
yeah, they might show up. And people would talk very conversationally, you know, about, oh, I saw a ghost yesterday. And I'd be like, well, really? Like, how did you know? And one of the things was, I remember one guy saying, well, I saw a man and he had no feet. And he was walking down the road, but he had no feet. And that told me that he was a ghost. And, you know, when you get that kind of first person report, it's kind of woo, you know?
That's great.
And we just heard some terrific stories about, you know, graveyards and haunts and snakes that roll down the road with their tails in their mouths and all kinds of good stuff. You know, that's just part of the kind of everyday culture there. And I will say, you know, that everybody's familiar with Brer Rabbit stories. And you know, that's where Joel Chandler Harris collected many of those stories, was in South Carolina. And if you read them, they can be difficult to read because he wrote them in dialect, you know, put that in air quotes. But the dialect is like Gullah English.
Oh, interesting.
Wow.
Cool.
Yeah, that and the name Gullah Geechee, I've been reading that there's a lot of people don't really know where that name comes from. I know there's like the folk hero Gullah Jack, which is a very interesting fellow, like helped start a revolution. He was a conjure man, but there seems to be a because there are also like a lot of different nations, African nations represented in the culture too. So like there are a lot of different languages spoken, and they kind of all coalesced into the Gullah culture.
And when I was a kid, you know, Geechee was like a put down. You know, it was like somebody who was like countrified and backward. Oh, that old Geechee, da 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 da. You know, so it's an example of one of those words that's been retrieved and given a positive meaning from having been, you know, just a kind of a slur against someone. But
Like
now
hillbilly.
like you're saying, it's I've heard, I've read that they think Gullah might come from Angola, from like a form of the word Angola, or Geechee from the, I think there's a river called the Ogeechee River or something like that. That's the thing. So many of these things are lost to history, what the origins are.
Yeah. So the other thing about the importance of this is that in a lot of other places in the United States, there was a lot more mixing, and the different strains of the different Euro, like Germanic and Scots-Irish, as well as the different Native American heritages, kind of mixed a lot more. Whereas in the Sea Islands, there was a more like pure African cultural memory. So you're able to see like some of the more African roots of different medicines and how they were used. So could you tell us a little bit about how what some of the differences are between the Gullah, Geechee, and the African uses of herbs, rather to compared to like the more Euro-American and Native American?
I was thinking about that question, and that was a big part of my book, was just trying to get an understanding of how were these herbs used in the Sea Islands compared to what I could learn about how they were used by American Indians or by Europeans. And I don't find sharp lines in a way, and I'm sure you saw that if you look, you there's often there are a lot of overlaps, which raises that age-old question: how do people figure out what different plants were good for? Because you can see that people from these different traditions were sort of all landing in some cases on the fact that this plant is good for your stomach, or this plant is good if you have a cold or something like that. So rather than thinking about the differences, what your question made me think about another thing that I guess we'll never know exactly, but how did these different groups learn from each other? And I imagine these enslaved Africans coming to the Carolina coast, and at the time that the earliest ones arrived, there would still have been Native Americans there too. And so the kinds of exchanges of probably like me, like, what's this plant for? People asking each other, what do you use? And in some cases, we know that there are plants like okra, I think, that people were successfully brought over from West Africa. But most of the plants that the ancestors of the Gullah Geechee would have encountered would be native, to the Americas or brought over from Europe. And so you can kind of imagine these conversations and, as I was saying, and exchanges about what do you use and why do you use it, and the people who become the specialists, kind of teaching other people that this is what I use, and here's why I use it. I mean, you just wish you could somehow go back in time and be a party to some of those conversations, but we just have to kind of imagine it and imagine those exchanges.
Yeah, and there really only has to be like one interaction for knowledge to be diffused, you know?
Yes, I think so. Especially if
And
something
also,
looks like it works, and people adopt it.
the other thing, if a plant works, then it's gonna work, you know? If something works, then you're gonna figure out how to use it. And the other thing I was thinking about too, looking over your book again, the cutting up illnesses into physical illnesses, spiritual influenced illnesses, and like occult, the causes of illness. And that's actually like in today's America, we think of that as an odd way of looking at things, but it's actually very common in the history of the world, you know, and like looking at Anglo-Saxon herbalism, even through to like 16th Renaissance English herbalism, like they differentiated between physical illnesses and diseases that were caused by either spirits, bad spirits, or hexes and curses and so on too. So this way of seeing is common throughout the world.
It's universal. I agree with you. And what I found in South Carolina and also Jamaica too, there are some conditions where right out of the gate, people will say, I think you've been hexed. But in other cases, it's more like if you just don't get better, then people start using different explanations. So it's almost like a gradation. It's a maybe it's a pain that starts out and you think it's a sprain. So you use, like some kind of compress for it, or you drink some sort of tea or something, but then the pain just hangs on. And then people come up with other explanations. Well, maybe the reason you feel sick is because so and so happened. And so now you're going to use maybe a different set of medicines. And sometimes it's the same practitioner. This is what I found again in both South Carolina and in Jamaica, is there are magical practitioners. They're not going to just announce themselves to you. You have to kind of come up on it sideways. And
Yeah.
sometimes it turns out, oh, it's the same. Actually, there was one guy I'm thinking of. He told me about some just herbs that people use. He was also like a major figure in the church. And it was also rumored that you could go to him, if you'd been hexed, because he knew about plants. So he knew about all kinds of plants, so it's not necessarily sharp lines, between all those different roles. And but it, that the magical part takes some doing, because people, like I found in South Carolina, like if you ask people, like, do you believe in hexes? They're gonna no. They're just gonna tell you no. So you because you, but you have to just wait, and then you might start to hear some stories,
Right.
and it's like being a kid at the dining room table. Don't show too much interest in the story. Just
Totally.
listen. Commit it to memory, and then you'll hear what somebody did. Somebody, for instance, it's believed like if you want to attract a man, you put some menstrual blood in his food, and then he will be like, just attached to you. And then you, so you'll might hear a story. Well, I heard that she did so and so and so and so. Or conversely, they have all kinds of things to do to make people sick, and so yeah, those traditions are alive. And people are believers. One thing I found is the tricky part, I guess I would say, is there are people who I think who probably have genuine healing powers on the occult side, and then there's lots of pretenders. And the trick is to distinguish, between the two.
Yeah, definitely. And then there are illnesses that seem, very very physical, and it's a sprain, and then you heal it. But then there's also sometimes illnesses that come also with objects falling out of your hands constantly, or like then everybody in your house getting sick, or from different things, So then there can be, you have to go use different methods for that. But also it makes sense that like the same person in the community who knows a lot about herbs is gonna and is well respected in the church. It's going to be somebody who is able to heal multiple things. And you find that also throughout the world too, like
Yes,
the
yeah.
cunning folk in England,
Exactly. And without, what's the word I want to use? It's not like bad, good, it's just different kinds of illnesses. And yes, and as you said, and some skilled elder will be a person who can handle, diagnose, and handle the whole range.
Did you find also examples of ways people will protect themselves from hexes or curses?
Oh yeah, they I'm trying to think of an example. Well, the woman when I mentioned I traveled a couple times with a woman, she was a linguist, the woman who was doing the research on the Gullah language. Once we stayed in this little house, and once she said to me, like, don't you smell that garlic? And I said, oh, I actually didn't smell it. And she said, yeah, I smell garlic. She said, I think somebody who lived here before, like, put it down, to keep spirits and things out of the house. So people used garlic. They used different kinds. I'm actually thinking of some examples from Jamaica because those were more obvious. But, you could use like water or eggs. I remember, so this will be a Jamaican story, but once going to a house where with a nurse, went with a nurse, and a woman had just had a baby, and we were going to like check on the status of the baby. And she was in the back room, and in the front room, in the corner, was a glass with some rum in it, and there were a couple playing cards and like an egg. So, you get the picture. I said to the nurse, because this was a rhetorical question, because you can figure, I said, oh, what's that? She's like, that's nothing. And I'm like, okay, bingo. We're protecting the baby, with this, keeping the bad spirits off. So I'm trying to think if there were other, I would say another protective thing that people would talk about in the Sea Islands is like, suppose you left something at somebody's house, like you left your scarf at somebody's house. And you were like, oh, I left it at Fred's house. They would say, maybe, well, maybe you should just don't go get it because Fred might have put a hex on it or something, on your possession. So it might just be, you might best be better off leaving it there.
That's
So it's you're protecting yourself. It's not necessarily like an amulet or something, but you're protecting yourself from those vibes. And I'll just tell you a plug for myself. Years after hearing all these stories, I wrote a fiction book called The Book of Secrets, where I tried to incorporate some of these folk stories and things into the plot line because I didn't actually talk about them in hoodoo medicine, but I'd heard these stories and these beliefs, and I kind of amplified them in the book because it is fiction. But to try to capture that, I think in environments like that, the line, so to speak, between the natural world and the supernatural world is more permeable than in this kind of standard Western, life. And so, and that's part of what makes it kind of scary, but also intriguing. And that's part of what I've wanted to capture.
Yeah, I noticed that book. I haven't read that book yet, but I noticed it was also a part one. So is there a
Yes,
part two coming
there
out?
is now. I just finished the draft of it.
That's awesome. Congrats. That's so
Thank
cool.
you. Thank you.
Or
Yay.
how about a part of three?
No, that's what my daughter said.
Refreshing.
It's like, I told her I don't have the energy for part three. She said, that's because you just finished part two. Just give it time.
You might learn some new things and you need in the future, but that's really cool. Part one and part two.
Yeah, you could do some more Jamaican things. So, but the hoodoo medicine is, contrary wise to the title, is more about the straight herbal uses of plants, the medical, physical uses. And did you find that there were some people who would do everything, or do this and that, but was there a lot of people who would do just herbs or just the conjure or
Well, it's a little hard to say. There's definitely people who say they do only the herbs. They'll say, I just do like good medicine or something. And so you have to take their word at it. I don't think I talked to anybody who only did conjure. But I did talk to people who did both. And in a way, it goes back to, well, partly what we were saying about people with expertise have expertise in multiple areas. And also because, as I was saying, there are some problems that people have, like infertility, where right out of the gate, I think there's a feeling that infertility is probably the result of being hexed. So if that's the case and you're going to some herbalist or something, they're probably going to use something different for that than if you come and you say, I have a cold or something like that, and what's a good thing for a cold? So I think it's more the case that there are people who are doing the whole mix versus specializing in one or the other. I mean, I know there are people who do probably, because you see them advertising and stuff that they can take hexes off of you. I didn't have much interaction with those people.
So you went to Jamaica too, and did you go there a lot?
I did. That's where I did my dissertation research.
Oh.
And there, I wasn't looking exclusively at what they call root medicine there. It was the same general question, what do you do when you get sick? And I talked to people in rural areas and I talked to people in Kingston in the capital. And I was interested in actually the whole range of options that people use in Jamaica, from bush medicine to going to, kind of regular doctors who might have been trained in the United States or England, and trying to understand who uses what and why and when. And there was a very active traditional medicine, use and practice in Jamaica too, as you might imagine, for some of the same reasons as in the Sea Islands. It's part of their history. It's also inexpensive. You have elders who can tell you what to use, and the same mixed feelings that you described about it being, this is the medicine that our parents use and our grandparents, but it's kind of old-timey medicine, kind of mixed feelings. But that again was many years ago, and the Rastafarians are big believers in bush medicine, and so they've really helped raise its profile with younger generations of Jamaicans.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, because yeah, Rastafarians are cool,
Yeah.
They're not these old.
Rastafarians were still like outlaws when I was there. Again, this was like 50 years ago, but getting cooler by the moment, And it's been interesting to see that complete kind of transformation of their image over the decades. Cool.
Yeah, it is the what comes into popular appeal and what passes out is always, it changes. It's everything is constantly changing.
Yes. And to your point that you made earlier, Isaac, I've actually been to a number of like Caribbean islands, and we were in Guadeloupe just a few months ago. So Guadeloupe is in the Eastern Caribbean, that little chain that goes on the east, and it's part of France. And first it was a French colony, and now it's what they call like a département. So it's like a official part of France. But there's what interested me since the last time I was there, which was about 20 years ago, is now they too, just the way you were describing, are really interested in their kind of local culture. Like they have a kind of French that the French call French patois, but they call it Creole, and they're really using Creole more and developing like books in that language, and you see it on signs and things. A lot of interest in local plants for healing and for eating, and just a sense of here's who we are. We're not mainland French people. We have our own identity. We have our own foods, our own language, our own music, and so forth. And it's really interesting to see that happening there.
Yeah, I think that there's this tendency in like the globalized industrial civilization for like a de-individualization, It's like everything is cookie cutter, You can go to the same mall and or the well the same Arby's, the same Sonoma.
Yeah, isn't that terrible? Yes. But people are pulling away from that. Like you're saying, people are, thank God, people are pulling away from that.
And it's really great that there's still like the living the lineages to that are still alive to draw from, because
Yes,
in
yes.
a lot of places they are have been totally wiped out, So going back to like the plants that the people in the Sea Islands worked with and are so there's a lot of native plants, mostly native plants, but there also are like African plants and some European plants too. What were like the main plants that people would go to for like everyday problems?
Things that are not that unusual necessarily, but like snake root for colds, and mullein, pine tar, sweet gum. Because if you think about it, what are the main things that people suffer from? You have colds, you have stomach aches, and then you have body aches, and you have fevers, and I have that list in the back that I'm looking at right now that just describes, and you'll see things clustered, under those kinds of headings, because those are the things that people have. So under fever, I heard about like 10 or 12 different things that you could use for fever, and multiple things for headache, and several different kinds of tonics, because people feel weak or they feel bad and they want something that's going to perk them up, and numerous things for colds. So let's say they would just be plants that grow commonly along the roadside, because that's where I did a lot of my research, is just literally walking down the road with people and walking and talking, and then having them point to different plants, and we'd pull it up, and I'd photograph it or press it or something like that. So just very common kind of things from the environment.
Some of the plants that stuck out to me especially were like plants like okra, which came from Africa and are useful for so many things, both as a food and a medicine.
Yes, yeah.
And then think of
Like
like
cotton, you know,
cotton, yeah.
agricultural crop and a medicine. Yeah.
And then things like pine tar, which just seemed like such a powerful medicine in general. And pines are all across the world, but you can use them in the same way, the tar at least. But then also plants like poke root and angelica tree, which are some of my favorite plants. Like I've always had a connection with poke root since I was a kid, you know, being out in the woods. But that's a native plant. And angelica tree is it's such a striking plant. Have you ever met it in the wild?
Not
Or maybe
lately. So tell
Espinosa.
me what you like about it.
Well, it's just such a it's so striking because it has these tall, thin stems, trunks, I guess. It's a multi-stemmed, like forest edge small tree, but it has these giant spikes. So they call it devil's walking stick as well as angelica tree. So it's like the devil and the angel.
Oh,
And
yeah.
it has these giant multi-composite leaves. They're like, I think that's the biggest leaf of any plant native to North America, because they're like multi-compound, and they're like, it can be like 3 feet across by 3 feet.
Lord.
And then they have these giant like candelabra flowers in the summer, which are buzzing with insects. So I just every time I whenever I see that plant, I just, like, get a little, ooh, that's a great plant. There's a considered invasive plant that's Aralia alata from Japan and Korea and China, that's now in the East Coast a lot. That's it's similar in a lot of ways, but also it's different. But there, yeah, I just love that one.
You asked me what a plant that I liked, which was a
Yeah.
great question, and I thought of two, but they're not, there's nothing maybe that unusual about them, but one is life of one that's in the book is Life Everlasting, that I
Yeah.
like because I like the name so much.
Yeah,
I mean, I
me
just
too.
like the
Yeah.
concept, Life Everlasting, and it's kind of a all-purpose plant. You know, there's like lots of it's in the African American tradition, the Native American tradition, European tradition, and used for lots of different things. Not a spectacular plant in terms of how it looks, but just kind of a workhorse of a plant, you know?
Nice.
And then the other plant that I like is mint, very
Oh, yeah.
ordinary. I have some mint on my deck. I just admire mint because it is so strong. Nothing kills it, I
Yeah.
swear. You know,
Yeah.
it's I it my the mint that's on my deck is completely neglected. It just sits out there. It's out there right now. It looks, you know, now it's all brown and, you know, it's freezing and whatever. And then it'll be back in about, fortunately, here in Virginia in about a month. It'll start, you know, sprouting again. And it's so durable and it works, you know, you drink it and you feel better. It works on your stomach. So that would be another one of my favorites.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
do you work with plants in your daily life much or not as much? You're more of a scholar.
I work with them. I'm fortunate to still live in the country. I mean, I that's just essential for my mental health, to still be out where the plants outnumber the people. That's really important to me. And so in that sense, they are very much a part of my life. And I do a lot of gardening. So now I'm working with them in the house and on the deck, as mentioned, and then kind of keeping an eye on them in the larger landscape. Living in Northern Virginia, it's, you know, it's not quite as botanically rich as South Carolina, but it's a beautiful part of the country. And you know, the winters are fairly short. Things are already beginning to sprout in the yard. And so, you know, you feel the richness of nature. And as I said, that's a really important part of my mental health. And so I feel like I'll always have that connection to plants in that sense. So I'm not going out so much collecting stuff to brew anymore, but taking walks, continuing to learn the names of them and learn about them. You know, that's an endless pursuit.
For sure.
Yeah, once a plant person, always a plant person.
Yes. It's in you. It's like you said, it's just part of you.
Yeah. And just being in the woods, being in the garden
Oh,
is
yeah.
very important. Has there been anything surprised you about the reception of the book over the years? Just maybe the fact that it's continued to grow in popularity, but anything else?
Well, probably a couple things. So one is it's been very gratifying to see the growth in popularity. As I said, it first came out in 78, probably had very modest sales. I don't actually know what the sales were, but then went out of print. And in the late 90s, I thought, you know, seems like people are more interested in herbal medicine than ever. So that's when I thought, let me republish this. And I worked with a small publisher in South Carolina who went out of business, but by that time Amazon existed, and I was able to sell the rest of the, you know, inventory on Amazon, and now it's print on demand. So now it's kind of perpetuity. And sales kind of percolated along. What I didn't expect, I think the rise of social media, you know, with Gullah Geechee people who discovered the book and began writing about it, helped publicize it. And then COVID, of all things, sales just shot up during COVID. And that wasn't me at all. But I think some influencer must have said that they were maybe using it, you know, to make teas or something like that. I don't actually know the genesis of it. All I know was that it suddenly became more popular than ever. And so that's been really interesting. And as I was saying in the beginning, I just feel fortunate that I've lived long enough to experience that arc. I mean, I gave a talk about hoodoo medicine, I think it was 2 years ago, to the Herb Society of America, you know, which is like an almost all white group, middle-aged, mostly women. But you know, you think, wow, this is really mainstream now. Like they've discovered this book, and they were interested in Gullah Geechee sort of culture and heritage. And so in addition to people just becoming aware of the book, I'm really glad that they're becoming aware of the Gullah Geechee people and of their own history. And I will just say, not so much related to the book, but because we were talking about it a little bit earlier, one of the troubling things that was actually starting when I was in Wadmalaw in the 70s was that the land was being sold and or taken from the Black families who owned it. So in some cases, you know, it was the classic story of the developer who comes in and offers people more money than they've ever seen before in their lives, and they take it. Or there were ways in South Carolina where you could basically legally steal land from people. So to give you an example, in South Carolina at that time, if you paid somebody's taxes for 3 years in a row, then you owned their property. And so what would happen would be like some developer would come in and say, "Hey, Isaac, you don't have to worry about your taxes this year. I paid them for you." And you're like, "Hey, thanks, dude," you know, because you don't know what's happening, you know. And then the next thing you know, a couple of years later, your land is now belongs to that developer. So that was starting to happen then. And you might have seen that story just a few months ago that was saw it on Google News talking about an elderly Black woman in Hilton Head who was holding out against the developers, you know, because Hilton Head was still almost all Black when we were there. And now if you go, there's like no signs of the Gullah Geechee, almost no signs of the people who lived there before and of their culture. It's really a difficult place to visit. And that's happened with several of the islands. But the good thing, as I said, is that the younger generations are fighting back. They're fighting back in terms of loss of the land. They're also just fighting back in terms of saying, "We're here, you know, and you're not going to erase us." And they're having the festivals and other ways of just raising up that culture and making sure that it doesn't become lost in that kind of flattening that Isaac was describing, that, you know, otherwise like takes over communities and obliterates their previous existence.
Yeah, it's a very painful thing to watch when, like developers just come in and do whatever they want and change the land, forever.
Right. Build a, you know, let's what might look like a shack, you know, as I said, because people were not, they didn't have a lot of money. They had wealth within, so to speak, the richness of the culture. But right, a developer can come in and say, "Let's take this unsightly shack and put up a $600,000 vacation house instead. And you
Uh-huh.
know, what city council person is going to argue with that? You know, to them, it's like a win situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I've been to the Sea Islands once or twice, maybe to go to the beach. But that does seem how like a lot of people in the larger the US culture see the Sea Islands these days. You know?
Destination,
Right.
right.
And it's sad that that culture has been destroyed in a lot of ways, but again, it is nice to see that there's a revitalization happening. Yeah. So if people are interested in this book,
And I have an even newer book, actually, that is a like a historical memoir that's called Emma's Postcard Album, Black Lives in Early 20th Century, which is about uses my grandmother's postcard collection to talk about her life and the larger kind of world of 100 years ago and what was
Yeah.
going on in the United States and going on with Black Americans. They can go to my website. That's probably the easiest thing, drfaithmitchell.com, because it has all the books and it has a form where you can reach me and it has events and eventually we'll have a clip of this podcast on it.
Yes,
Yeah.
awesome.
Awesome.
Is there anything else that you're looking forward to coming up here soon that you're working on or that you're excited about?
Well, I got to work on Book of Secrets Part Two. Like I said, I finished the draft, so now I have to start at the beginning,
Yeah.
right? And read it over again. I'm one of
Yeah.
those people who edits and edits and edits.
Yeah.
And, you know, actually, I'm thinking about doing like maybe almost like a 50th anniversary edition of Hoodoo Medicine, like at least to put a new preface in it. It
Yeah.
just talks, just as we've been talking today, just talks about what the world was like when the book first came out and what's happened over the decades.
Love
Because
that.
I think, yeah, it's an interesting story and it gives people some context.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Faith. This has been such an awesome conversation. I really enjoyed speaking with you today.
Well, thank you again.
Yeah.
Okay,
All right.
cheers.
Okay, bye-bye.